This is Richard Verone, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Bill Hancock. Today is June 30th, 2003. It's 10:07 a.m. Central Standard Time. I am in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University. And Mr. Hancock is in Hamilton, Ohio. Sir, why don't we start with some biographical information on yourself. Could you tell me when and where you were born and a little bit about your childhood?
I was born in Cincinnati, Ohio, March 9th, 1948.
Mm-hmm.
Had a wonderful childhood, lived with, you know, my mother and father, great people.
Mm-hmm.
Got a brother. He's 3 years and 3 months younger than me, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I went to school, graduated from high school.
Mm-hmm.
Actually enlisted before I graduated. I went on a 90-day delay plan.
Huh.
But,
okay.
Yeah, I graduated from Coleraine High School. Mm-hmm. Started working when I was 14 years old in order to buy my own car when I got to be 16.
Right.
And that's pretty much, you know, the childhood that
okay.
I had. It was wonderful.
Okay. What did your father or your mother do for a living?
My father worked in a slaughterhouse. He was a butcher.
Really? Okay.
And worked there for 50-some years.
Wow.
And my mother was mostly a homemaker. After we got older, she worked little, small part-time jobs keep busy once we weren't in the house all the time, but
mm-hmm.
she basically just stayed at home and worked, you know, worked as a
mm-hmm.
homemaker.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Tell me what kind of student you were. What are your earliest memories of going to school?
Well, I was a real good student up until I started driving.
Oh, really?
And started driving and got a little interested in girls, and then the grades went down a little bit. I mean, it
mm-hmm.
wasn't real bad, but I was pretty good student. I was a gifted child when I was in grade school.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm a pretty good student all the way through
yeah.
school.
What were your favorite subjects?
Math and science and history.
Okay. Any particular reason? Or were you just good at those?
I was just good at math and science, and I just liked history.
Yeah? Did you read a lot when you were a kid?
Yes, my father was an avid reader, even though he wasn't. He had only went through the sixth grade.
Okay.
And, but he was an avid reader, read all the time, and I kind of picked that up from him.
Right.
So I read a lot myself.
Right. You said that you worked when you were young. Tell me what kind of work you did.
I worked for an outfit that set up circuses and carnivals, and you know, we just set up like the tents and
mm-hmm.
All the booths and things like that, and did all the prizes, and so I worked a lot in the evenings distributing things to circuses and carnivals, did debutante parties and
mm-hmm.
All kinds of things like that.
Okay. How long did you do that?
Up until the time I went into service. So mm-hmm. I did that for about 4 years.
Okay. Was there an expectation from your parents or from yourself that you would go to college?
Yes, there was.
Okay.
But, you know, when the with the war going on, and
mm-hmm.
I just decided that I'd rather go into service.
Okay. What year did you graduate high school, Bill?
1966.
Okay. Tell me about your high school years. What do you remember about those?
Well, they were, like I said, I worked
mm-hmm.
all the time, and I worked pretty much 40 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked at school, and as soon as school was over, where I worked at was right next to the school.
Okay.
So I would get off of... I would get done at school, I would walk right over there, and then I'd work till maybe 10 o'clock in the evenings,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, come home and do whatever homework I had, and then go to bed.
Sounds like you were very busy.
I was very busy.
It sounds like you were driven. Was this typical of your family and your the group that you ran around with, or were you kind of the exception?
I was probably the only one that was working,
okay.
but the group that I ran around with, I had a lot of... You know, I had a lot of friends that I hung around with whenever I got time,
mm-hmm.
a lot of friends from the neighborhood and stuff. But
mm-hmm.
as far as the friends just from school, I had friends while I was in school, but nobody that I hung around with after school was over,
okay.
pretty much, just the ones around my neighborhood.
Okay. What was the first car you got when you were 16? You said you were working toward buying that. What'd you get?
I got my grandfather's car when he died.
Uh-huh.
I bought it from my grandmother. It was a 1957 Plymouth Belvedere. Weighed about 8,000 pounds, I think.
Sounds like a good car.
Mm. Yeah, it was kind of funny because my grandfather was a pretty good drinker, so when I bought the car from him, the first day I was out there cleaning it out, I found bottles of liquor hid everywhere.
Did you? Full bottles?
Full bottles of liquor, you know, pints and stuff. I found them underneath the seats. I found them under the spare tire in the trunk. I must have found four or five bottles.
Wow. What'd you do with them?
Actually, I hid them and kept them.
Somehow I knew you were going to say that. Okay. Did you play sports in high school?
I played football.
Did you?
Yes.
What position?
I was a wide receiver. I was a running back. I ran back punts and kickoffs, and I played defensive back.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. Were you a pretty good athlete?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we had, I was always raised. I was raised, as a matter of fact, I started playing football when I was about 6 years old for the YMCA.
Uh-huh.
And I played all the way up until I was maybe 30 years old.
Really? Okay. Any other sports?
I played some baseball, you know, some softball and stuff like that, some baseball, but football was my main love.
Okay, okay. So in high school, you're there at a really crucial time in American history, in the 60s, in the mid-60s. What did you know about America's involvement in Vietnam at this time in Southeast Asia?
At first I didn't know a whole lot, and then, you know, in like 60, I guess, late 65 and early 66, you know, when we started hearing about the troops going over and, you know, when it was just advisors and stuff, I really didn't know too much about it.
Right.
But then when it started getting on the news on a regular basis, you know, I started hearing a little more about it and understood that it kept getting bigger and bigger and, you know, just figured it was time for me to be in there.
Why did you make that decision? Why did you feel that?
Every male in my family who was eligible at some time or another has been was in the service. My grandfather was in World War One. My father was in World War Two.
What did your father do in World War Two?
He was in the Navy. He was on a minesweeper, which was hit by a kamikaze.
Really?
Off of Saipan.
Wow.
And my grandfather had been in the Army, and my uncles. My father came from a family of 13, and almost all my uncles had been in the Korean War.
Did you talk with your father or any of your uncles about their experiences?
Well, I listened mostly to my father and my grandfather when they were playing cards, and they would bullcrap about, you know, how they would tell their war stories and to each other and get on each other's back because they were in different services and stuff. And so that's how I learned mostly about it.
Did your father talk about the kamikaze attack?
No.
He did not. How'd you find that out?
I went to his, he had a reunion here in Cincinnati. And that's years and years later. That was probably in 91 or something like that. And that's when I heard most about it.
Really? Why do you think he didn't talk to you about that?
I just think it was traumatic for him, and he just didn't like to talk about that part of it.
Right. Did you ask him when you were younger about his experiences, and did he kind of decline that, or was it something that was off?
I just felt that he really didn't want to talk about any of the bad stuff. He would talk about things he did in the service with his buddies, you know, when they were on Liberty and things like that, but he just never talked about that kind of stuff. So.
Okay. How much of it obviously was an influence, as you said, that so many men in your family had served.
Yes.
Why the Marine Corps?
I just decided I wanted to be with the best. I had heard the Marine Corps was the best, so I figured I'd do that, you know. My father held a high regard for him, though he was really mad at me when I enlisted in the Marine Corps.
Really? Why?
Well, he wanted me to go to college for one thing, and he just, I guess he knew what war was all about and just didn't want me over there in that capacity.
Do you know, did he support the war at this time in 66?
Yes.
Okay, okay. Now, you said he was in the Navy, right?
Yes.
Okay. And the Marine Corps kind of technically is a branch of the Navy, but he still did not. He was just basically
the men's department.
Yeah, he didn't want you.
That's what I always told him anyway.
What's that?
He used to tell me the Marine Corps was just the department in the Navy. I told him, yeah, it was the men's department.
He just didn't want you to be in harm's way. Is that it?
Yes.
Okay, okay. How does your mother feel about you joining the service?
Oh, she hated it.
Really?
Yeah, she hated it.
Why?
Most of them, she didn't want me over there, you know, in that capacity. They knew where I was going. they knew where I was headed. So.
Did you know where you were headed? Did you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's why we enlisted. I enlisted with several other people. Mm-hmm. My best friend enlisted with me, mm-hmm. and we went in on the buddy plan, which only lasted till we got over there.
Right. So the buddy plan, meaning you got to go through training together.
We got to go through training and everything together.
Right. Now, you said you did a kind of an early 90-day entry. What was that about? How did you do that?
Well, I enlisted, and then you could delay your... You could enlist, and then you could delay going in for 90 days.
Right.
And so I enlisted actually before... We enlisted before we were out of high school.
Okay.
And then we delayed it so we could finish high school and then stay home most of the summer.
Right.
Before we went in.
Okay. Okay. What did you do the summer before you went in?
Worked. Remember? I worked mostly and just tried to have some fun. Nothing spectacular or anything. I went on a vacation to Cumberland with my mother and father, but that was about it.
Okay. So tell me, where did you go for basic? You went to San Diego, is that right?
I went to San Diego, yes.
Okay.
MCRD.
All right. What are your memories of the base there, San Diego, and your training?
Hotter than heck and rougher than a cob.
Yeah?
Yeah. It was more than I expected.
Really? This is the fall of 66?
Yes.
Okay.
I think I went in I actually went in August of 66.
Okay.
And that's when I actually reported to MCRD, San Diego.
Okay.
And so it was hot out there, and it was, yeah, like I said, it was far more than I expected. It was just, it was tough training, but it was something that once I got through, I was proud that I had made it.
What do you remember most about the training? What comes to your mind's eye?
Just working from, you know, early in the morning till in the evening, and all of the marching and run, especially the running and formation and things like that that we did, the physical training, and how the DIs were, you couldn't do anything right. You know, if you were a Marine Corps recruit, didn't matter what you did, it couldn't possibly be right.
Right.
It was a way that they had of making everybody work together.
Tell me about your DIs. Were they veterans of military conflict? Had they been in World War
II? Two of them had been in Vietnam already.
Really?
Yes.
Did they talk to you guys about that?
They didn't talk. They didn't, of course, the DI never talks to you one-on-one just to have a conversation.
Right.
You know, they told us, you know, that we had better pay attention and that we had better learn these things if we wanted to survive. And, you know, and we're really pushed us to make us do the things we needed to do and to get into kind of shape we needed to be in, to learn things that we would need to know when we got over there and things of that nature.
Right. What kind of things were they trying to tell you, to teach you to survive in Southeast Asia?
Mainly being alert, learning how to use all the weapons. They, you know, they taught us about booby traps. They taught us, you know, some of the things that the NVA would do and, you know, the VC would do, and just tried to give us an overall picture of what it was like.
How relevant.
You know, but you can never do. But.
Right, right. Well, how relevant was it once you got there? Did it help you? Did you reflect back on it?
Well, you reverted to your training. You know, when something happened, it was funny because you just instinctively did what you had been taught to do. And so, yeah, the training was pretty relevant.
Yeah. What was your typical day like?
At boot camp?
Yes.
Typical day was they'd get you up at, I think it was 5 o'clock in the morning, you know, reveille would sound. And
now, how would they wake you up? Would they throw the trash
in the middle? No, they had a recorded version of reveille.
Uh-huh.
And it was funny because it was a record.
Uh-huh.
And every morning, before the reveille, the bugle would actually sound, you could hear the click of the record being started.
Oh, really?
And that would I'd get up at that click every morning before the actual reveille started. That's how, and you know, and immediately after that, you jumped out of the sack and made your bed, cleaned up your area. You ran over to the showers. You had like 10 minutes to get showered, shaved, and everything else. And I had never shaved before, so they gave me one of them double-edged razors, and I cut myself to ribbons. you know, and then after you got showered and shaved and everything, you went to Chow Hall and got breakfast. And you started. It was either drill or physical education or some classes that they did or something. They taught you a lot of Marine Corps history, and I think they did that to because of the tradition that they expected you to keep up. There was a lot of drill on Marine Corps history. You know, we knew pretty much all the famous Marines there were to know. And all the battles that the Marine Corps had fought in and, you know, things of that nature. I think they were, you know, just trying to instill in you that you were there to keep up the tradition.
Right.
So,
what would you say was the most challenging aspect of it for you?
I think the physical and the mental training especially. I think the mental toughness that they instilled in you was the hardest part to get used to. Like I said, you could never do anything right. It was hard mentally for me to adapt to that. I did, but I mean, that was just a real tough thing. I thought I was in good shape because I had played football all those years, but I didn't do the kind of things that they had me doing.
Right.
When you run in a formation or something, it's a lot harder than just going out and running by yourself. So that was a little tougher than I expected. I didn't expect to. You know, the first week that we ran, they just had us running a quarter mile in formation, and it was damn near killed me.
Really? A quarter mile?
A quarter mile.
Wow.
And I had run all my life, but I had not had to run at somebody else's pace and things like that. That was just real tough to do.
Tell me about the weapons training you received there in San Diego.
At San Diego, the only weapons training we received was we spent 2 weeks on the rifle range. At Las Pulgas, which was up at Camp Pendleton. And the first week was what they called snapping in, and you sat there for a whole week, and you aimed at these little black spots on these white 55-gallon drums, and you took classes, and, you know, basically you learned about sight alignment and sight picture and windage and you know, things of that nature. But the first week was just a snapping in. You never got to fire around.
Okay. Were you on the M14 at this point?
The M14 was what we used, yes.
Okay. Okay. And how'd you do once you got to shooting, actually?
I was a marksman.
Okay. All right. Now, when you switched to the M16 later, I'm assuming you did.
We switched to the M16 while I was in Vietnam.
Yeah, right. Did you prefer the M14 or the M16 or the
reverse? I preferred the M14 at that time because the M16s weren't working properly.
Right. Did you ever switch to the M16 A and then to the B? To the
No.
Okay. So you had the model that jammed all the time.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, the rifle didn't jam. It was the ammunition that was bad.
Right. Right. Okay. How long was your training there, the basic there at San Diego?
At San Diego, we were there. It was either 8 or 9 weeks.
Okay. And when you graduated, where did you go?
Then we went to Camp Pendleton for what they called Infantry Training Regiment.
Okay. Tell me about that. What do you remember about that?
Infantry Training Regiment was now you got into a lot more depth about landmine warfare, ambushes, patrols, you know, escape and evasion, you know, military code of conduct. It was not as tough mentally because we did get liberty, which we had never gotten in boot camp, but there was a lot more training as far as infantry tactics and things of that nature.
Right. Were they training you specific for Southeast Asia, or was this kind of general tactics?
They did some general and they did some specific things for Southeast Asia, like camouflage and, you know, search and destroy missions and, you know, ambushes and things of that nature, which we ran so much of later on.
How did you do with all that?
Oh, I did fine, I think.
Really?
You know, as it was, I was pretty much always did what I was told, you know. So.
Right.
So I adapted pretty good to that.
Okay. Once you got over to Southeast Asia, looking back, did that kind of, was it relevant, the training? I mean, did it?
Yes.
The ambushes and the search and destroy missions, was that kind of how you guys ran it over there as well?
Yes. We ran ambushes probably, I was on an ambush probably two-thirds of the nights that I was ever over there.
Really? Okay. And so looking back at the night ambush training you had at Pendleton, was it relevant? Was it the same?
It was relevant. It was basic. There was a lot more to learn once I got there,
right,
which I learned from the other guys that were there. But
right,
yeah, it was good training, you know, as far as the basic knowledge that we had to have.
Right. And what kind of weapons training did you have at Pendleton?
Just about everything you could think of. Fired the machine gun, fired the M79, fired the 3.5 rocket launchers, mm-hmm, fired BARs, and you know, threw grenades and used claymores and
mm-hmm,
just about every kind of weapon that we would actually encounter, we fired.
Mm-hmm. What was your preference?
I would have liked to have a machine gun. I wanted something that fired as many bullets as you could get.
Okay. All right. Well, of those weapons, which one were you most proficient at?
I was most proficient with the rifle.
Yeah. Okay. When you're training there, your instructors, how different were they from your time at the MCRD in San Diego? Was it more of a relaxed professional atmosphere, or were they still more in your face about?
It was a little more relaxed atmosphere. I mean, they would still get on you if somebody needed correcting, but it was overall it was more relaxed. It wasn't so rigid as it wasn't as rigid as in boot camp. You could do some stuff right.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, they knew where we were going. And, well, when we graduated from boot camp, you know, we got our orders at
mm-hmm
that point where we were going.
Right.
So 96 of the 98 people that were in my boot camp platoon had orders to go Fleet Marine Force Westpac, which was Vietnam.
Right. Were your instructors veterans of Vietnam?
Yes.
Okay. And at Pendleton, did you go into more detail with them? Did they talk to you more specifically about what they had been through?
They didn't tell us the basics of what they had been through, but mm-hmm, they gave us the basics of what they had seen and things like that, you know,
okay,
how to adapt to situations that had happened over there.
Okay. Okay. When did you finish at Pendleton? What do you remember?
Oh, I don't remember exactly. I would say it was... maybe
was it March or
no? That was like in November or December, and then we had basic infantry school after that, which was just more in-depth training.
Really, where was that?
That was also Camp Pendleton.
Okay, okay,
but that was just like more in-depth training and you know, squad tactics and
mm-hmm,
fire team tactics and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
And It was a little extension of ITR, which was just a little more in depth of, you know,
mm-hmm,
how each person in the unit was supposed to react.
Right. What did you think, and how did you feel about, you know, knowing the fact that you were going to Vietnam, you get in, and when you got your orders, and knowing that you were actually going into a war? How did you feel?
I was a little apprehensive, as you'd expect, but mm-hmm, I don't think at that time I even thought a whole lot about it, since everybody was going.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, it didn't affect me. I mean, when I enlisted, I was pretty sure that that's what was going to happen.
Right. Right. How about your family? How did they feel about it?
Oh, they hated it.
Okay. They had not come around, basically.
No. They didn't want me over there. They wanted me in college, so.
Okay. How much contact did you have with home before you shipped out?
I got sent home on a 20-day leave,
mm-hmm,
and I mean, I had called while I was in training in California when I was in ITR and BIS, but I got a 20-day leave before I was shipped out to Vietnam.
Okay, and how did you leave the country? Did you leave off the West Coast?
I went aboard ship.
Oh, really? Okay,
yeah.
Tell me about that. How did you, what ship, and how did you get over?
The ship that we were on was the Upshur, and it was a converted civilian ship that had been converted to carry troops, and we were all going over as replacements.
Okay.
So I forget how many of us were aboard that ship, but there were pretty many.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, we left on March the 9th, which was my birthday.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I was 19, turned 19 the day we left.
Uh-huh.
And we got over to Vietnam. I actually got with my company on the 29th of March.
Okay. How much training did they provide for you guys as far as Southeast Asian culture and Vietnamese culture before you were there?
Not a lot.
Yeah?
Not a lot as far as their culture.
Do you remember what they talked to you about?
No, I really don't remember much about any kind of training for culture.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, what did they tell you about the country? I mean, about what you, where you were going, why you were going, and
just that it was hot, and that in the Marine Corps they really don't tell you why you're going, just that you're sent there to do a job, and that's what you do.
Right. Right.
So.
Okay. What did you know about why the United States was in Vietnam at this point in 1966, 67?
The only thing I knew was that the South Vietnamese had asked us to come, and so that's why we were there.
Okay. Did you, go ahead.
I knew that the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong were trying to change them into communists, and that's the only thing that I knew.
Okay. So did you talk with your fellow Marines about why you were going? Was that any kind of like a bigger perspective? You know, here's the big picture. This is what's happening in Southeast Asia. Or was it more, okay, we're going to do a job and this is it?
No, just we're going to do a job and this is it. You know, I don't remember any political or any kind of talk like that. Just, you know, we enlisted. All of us were enlisted for one thing.
Right.
We had all enlisted, so we knew, had our own reasons why we were going.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I don't remember any talk like that, just that we were going to go over there and do a job. And
okay. Tell me what you thought about the one-year tour of duty policy. Did you think this was a good idea, or do you think it should have been more like World War II, where you just serve until the war ended? And I'm asking you this before you actually get in country. Did you think about it at the time?
No, I never even thought about it at
really?
The time.
Why not?
I was just at the time that I was going over there, I thought I was going with all my friends, so it didn't matter.
Okay.
But yeah, I never really gave any thought to the 1 year. Well, we had a 13-month tour duty that we were supposed to do in the Marine Corps, but I never really gave that much thought.
Okay. Well, what about looking back at it now? The 1 year tour of duty policy or the 13-month?
It was really, I think it was not a good way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for one thing, you were always teaching new men.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people left and you didn't go over and come back as a unit.
Mm-hmm.
Going over and coming back individually, I don't think, or going over individually, which was kind of the way we did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was the only one that went to my company off of our ship.
Wow.
So it was... you were a new guy, and you didn't know anyone.
Right.
And you hadn't trained with any of these people. You know, you hadn't been through anything with any of them. They had all been through everything when they got over there, and they kind of looked at you as somebody that could get them in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So,
how long did it take you to get over that, or for them to accept you?
It took a couple weeks until we had our first firefights.
And you could prove yourself, I guess.
Yeah, you had to prove yourself to, you know, the other people you were with.
Uh-huh.
If you didn't, they didn't have much to do with you.
Uh-huh. Okay. So this policy, you think, perhaps disrupted unit cohesiveness to a point?
To a point it did that, and to a point it left the new people isolated.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, you couldn't really get to know anyone until something had happened, and until you proved yourself. You
right.
had to prove, you know, you had to prove yourself before anyone wanted to have anything to do with you or share their foxhole with you or anything else. I mean, not that they didn't have to, but they didn't like it.
Right. When you arrived in Vietnam, where did you come into?
Our ship landed in Da Nang Harbor, so we disembarked at Da Nang.
Okay. What were your first impressions of Vietnam?
Hot.
Yeah?
And stunk.
What did it smell like?
Well, it's... later on, I found out that it was this Nook balm that they cook everything in. It's a fish sauce. And the whole country smelled like that. You know, you got used to it after a while, but when you first got over there, it was really pungent and really was kind of an offensive odor to us, you know, and it was, but as far as, you know, the heat mainly, it was like you couldn't breathe. It was dusty there, and even though it was kind of strange, when we first landed, they took us off the ship, and we didn't have any weapons or anything, and we're thinking, we're, you know, we went in on, from the ship to the dock, we went in on mic boats, and I'm thinking, we're going into this country that's having a war, and we ain't even got guns, you know.
Right.
Well, when we landed in there, you know, we the first thing I saw was a Dairy Queen.
Really?
In Da Nang, yeah. There were American shops there, and which was kind of strange. But we had, because we had sat out in the harbor, and we saw all the, you know, that the night before we had sat out in the harbor on the ship, and we had seen all these illumination rounds going off and tracers and everything else, and yet they sent us in there. We didn't have any weapons, and we're thinking, Jesus, this can't be good.
Right. When were you finally issued a weapon?
As soon as I got to the company.
Okay.
And to the company headquarters. They issued us all the gear we needed, you know, flak jackets, helmets, web gear, you know, weapons and everything else.
Okay. Tell me about the first couple of days once you got into Da Nang. What did you do? Where did they put you?
I was at the, I stayed at the company headquarters because the, my company was already out in the field.
Now, you knew exactly where you were going, which company you were assigned to?
They assigned us on the ship before they sent us in.
Okay.
And like I said, I was the only one that went to hotel company, so when I landed at the dock in Da Nang, a truck picked me up.
Just you?
Just me, from the comp, you know, from my company.
Wow.
And drove me out. They were on, I think it was Hill 190, and they, outside of Da Nang, and they drove me out there to the company headquarters. And like I said, there was, in all the huts and everything that were there for the company, there was no one. There were just a few guys there. A couple had been wounded and were coming back to the company. And, you know, sick or whatever, they had come back from R&R or something. Those were the only guys that were there at the time besides the company clerk and maybe the executive officer or something like that.
Right.
So then they issued me all my gear and everything, and I stayed there, I think it was two nights.
Where did you stay? Was it in a tent or a barracks? Or
It was like GP tents, general purpose tents that they had. But they had like hardwood floor, plywood floors, and so I stayed in there for a couple days until I got everything issued and got all my paperwork straight and everything for the company, and then they issued me a M79.
Okay.
And
then could you choose that, or they gave
that? No, they issued that to me.
Okay.
Well, they didn't let me keep that puppy long anyway because I was terrible with it.
Really?
Yeah, so we found that out very shortly, in very short order.
What? Why weren't you good at it? What happened?
Well, we got out to, when they flew me out, when they finally flew me out to the company that was on Operation Canyon, which was down near Chulai, and dropped, they, I flew out with a bunch of resupply that they were having.
By yourself?
By myself.
Now, let me ask you, Bill, you were by yourself the whole time here at headquarters for a few days. Did you associate with anybody? Did you feel isolated?
I felt isolated because most of the guys, you know, were already buddies and stuff, and they just kind of didn't warm up to somebody new real quick. But
how did you feel? I mean, were you apprehensive or were you eager to get out?
I was a little worried about things. Little apprehensive because it was strange. I knew where I was going, and you know, I knew the company was out in the field, and I'd be sent out there shortly. I didn't know how I'd be accepted. Didn't know what to expect or what was going on. So, yeah, I would say I was apprehensive.
Okay. So you were taken out with some supplies on a copter.
Yes.
Okay. Tell me about that.
Now we, you know, they flew us out to the company, landed, you know, and there wasn't any trouble at that point. And so, just, you know, it was like probably early morning. And they were on some, the company was up on some sand dunes where they had set up a perimeter for the night. They dropped me off. I met the platoon sergeant, and he took me and assigned me to the squad that I was going to be assigned to. And, you know, like I said, I had the M79 and stuff, and basically we didn't have any time because as soon as I got assigned, we moved down into these rice paddies that they were sweeping. And the very first day I got there, we're online moving through these rice paddies, and we started getting shot at.
Wow.
So,
and what happened?
It was just a bunch of VC. Nobody got hit. But, I mean, it was in the rice paddies. We were sweeping towards this village, and they started shooting at us, and you could see the bullets hit the water, and they were shooting mortars at us. Of course, the mortars would hit in the mud of the rice paddies and weren't having much effect or anything, but I'm thinking, is every freaking day like this?
You know? Welcome to Vietnam.
Yeah. Is it like this every day?
Did you ask that question to this, to your...
No, I really didn't ask anybody because I didn't know anyone.
Okay. Okay.
But anyway, that was that first day when we were going towards that village and we started getting shot at from this hut, the platoon sergeant, Sergeant O'Keefe. I was kind of a little bit behind because I was carrying the M79, and I was trailing behind the line by about 10 yards or so.
Right.
And so we started getting shot at from this hut. The platoon sergeant, Sergeant O'Keefe, calls me up there to just, they got up to the rice paddy dike and kind of got behind it. And he told me to, he said, hit that hut, you know, where they're shooting at us with the M79. Well, shit, I fired at it 20 times. I couldn't hit the damn thing. I was shooting them over the top of it, and they were blowing up. I was shooting them short, and they were blowing up. Finally, Sergeant O'Keefe come back to me, and he said, son, what are you doing? And I said, I'm trying to hit that hut. He said, well, you ain't doing it. I said, well, if they ran out the back, I might have got them. He said, give me that M79. He said, the only way you're going to kill any VC with that is to turn it around and beat them to death.
And that was it for the M79 with you?
Yeah, so he brought the... this other guy, Ramirez, over, and he said, give him your rifle and ammunition and everything. You take the M79. So I felt, I actually felt pretty bad about that. But that night, you know, after we got swept through the village and cleared it out, and that night is we'd go up on these dunes and sit up every night and set up a perimeter. Now I was feeling real bad about it. I was sitting there kind of depressed because nobody was really talking to me or anything.
Right.
And Sergeant O'Keefe came up to me, and he said, son, how you feeling? And I told him, I said, you know, I'm feeling pretty bad. I said, I'm sorry, you know, I couldn't hit that hut or anything. He said, look, you came when I called you. That's all that matters. You know, so he said, you'll do just fine.
How much did that mean to you?
That meant a bunch.
Yeah?
That meant a bunch.
When you said you swept through the village and cleared it, can you describe what that is for folks listening to this who, you know, who will have never done that? How do you sweep through a village?
When we, you know, we did squad rushes and stuff and finally got into the village and went from hut to hut, you know, well, the VC who had been there mostly had taken off or else they held their weapons and just acted like villagers or whatever the hell they did. But,
Did they tell you, I'm sorry for interrupting, did they tell you, here's what you're going to be looking for, Bill?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so we searched the huts and everything for ammunition or large storages of rice or, you know, anything, weapons, anything that could, you know, that would be associated with the VC and stuff like that. And I think they found some, you know, they found some small weapons caches or and some, you know, amounts of rice, which we blew up and stuff, but I don't think at that time we captured any VC or anything that I know of on that day anyway.
Right. Okay. So that night you get this, you get the talk from the sergeant, and what was the next day like?
Same thing. It was the same thing for about a week.
Really?
Every day go out in the rice paddies, every day they'd shoot at us. you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they killed a few, you know, in the next few days and stuff. But, mm-hmm. you know, later on, I was in a position in the perimeter at night up mm-hmm. on the dunes.
Mm-hmm.
And they put this recon sergeant in with me
mm-hmm.
in my position. And, you know, we killed a VC that was trying to probe into the lines. He mm-hmm. never did see us or anything, but
right.
Yeah, so that's the way my first operation went.
Can you describe when you set up defensively at night, what would you do? How would you set up?
Well, we would set up a platoon size perimeter,
mm-hmm.
and then we would send well, actually, we set up a company size perimeter.
Okay.
And then two of our squads, we had three squads in each platoon.
Mm-hmm.
Two of the squads would go on ambush every night, and one squad would help make up the company perimeter.
Okay.
But, you know, only one-third of our platoon was actually part of the company perimeter, and one-third of each platoon was part of the company perimeter.
Okay.
The other two squads from each platoon were on ambushes.
How large was your perimeter?
You know, I would say a couple hundred yards, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you're first there, did they tell you here's what you do at night on defense as a defensive position, or were you kind of left to your own?
No, you mostly just watched everybody else, mm-hmm. and you, like I said, you had somebody else in your position with you,
mm-hmm.
so you mostly watched what they did, and then when it come your time for watch, you just watch like hell.
Yeah. The first few times you did this, did you know what you were looking for or listening for?
Yeah, pretty much, I would say. You know, but, of course, when you're out there at night, and especially when you're brand new getting over there,
mm-hmm.
and you're staring out there, and the moon had a little light to it, but
mm-hmm.
all the bushes in that start moving when you stare at them for too
mm-hmm.
long.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you're startled by everything.
Right.
You know, you think everything's a bad guy.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever spot anybody out at night in this your initial time there?
I was there about 8 or 9 days when the guy walked into our position that we shot.
Mm-hmm.
Me and the recon sergeant.
Okay.
We saw him from pretty good ways off, and he was just going from bush to bush. And when he got close enough, then he never did see us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What would you say was the morale of the Marines you were with when you first arrived in the first few weeks?
I'd say it was pretty good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Did you see this change at all over time?
Not until we later on hit the NVA.
Okay.
Is this during
Hickory?
Yeah.
Okay.
As far as, you know, when you were fighting a VC, actually we had very few people that were I don't remember a lot of people being shot by the VC.
Uh-huh.
We had a lot of people that were hit by booby traps and
mm-hmm.
Mines and, you know, punji stakes and things of that nature. But,
mm-hmm.
yeah, the VC, and if you got in contact with the VC, it never really lasted very long.
Why not?
You know, they were farmers. They were out there to fire their so many rounds or whatever, and
mm-hmm.
and then they'd just go back home.
Mm-hmm.
And, so the firefights never lasted very long.
How does that make you feel? Was it more frustrating that you couldn't actually, you know, engage the enemy for a prolonged fight? Or is this something that, you know, you were expecting and this is what they told you, here's what's going to happen? And
no, I mean, I just don't think that the VC that we encountered,
mm-hmm.
the ones that we encountered was mostly small units, squad size or even smaller.
Hmm.
And so I think they knew that they didn't stand much chance
mm-hmm.
against us if they were in an extended firefight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe later on they got better training or whatever, but when mm-hmm. I first got over there, they just, you know, once we opened up, we had fire superiority and they didn't stand much chance.
Right, right. What would you say were the strengths and weaknesses of the Viet Cong?
They knew the terrain. They were, they could go home at night. they, you know, they knew all the people. They had very good intelligence because they watched us all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They'd see us. They'd see where we went. They, you know, but as far as, you know, they would probably have been pretty good fighters if they'd, and they were good fighters, but they were just didn't have the firepower that we did or the, you know, the unit cohesiveness, I don't think, that we did.
Okay. How about the NVA? What were their strengths and weaknesses and your general impressions?
The NVA were very tough. Didn't run, didn't, were well-equipped, were well-trained,
mm-hmm.
Worked real well in large units, had pretty good supporting arms and things of that nature,
mm-hmm.
artillery and mortars and rockets and machine guns and things of that nature, just like we did, everything except air power and Navy power.
Mm-hmm.
They had pretty much all the same thing.
Right. How long would it take you to recognize that you were up against the NVA versus
Didn't
the
take you long, because they tried to get as close to you as they could.
Really? Did you ever encounter forces like the Pathet Lao or the Khmer? Anybody from Laos or Cambodia that you're aware of?
Not that I know of.
How about Chinese soldiers?
We found during Operation Hickory
mm-hmm.
A lot of Chinese stuff. So I guess, I don't know if it, you know, we found papers and things like that from mm-hmm. the Chinese, but I don't know if it was just from advisors
mm-hmm.
or whatever, but I mean, I don't ever remember seeing any Chinese units or anything.
Okay. Could you describe the daytime versus the nighttime? What were the major differences, and how did you feel about each?
Well, during the daytime, you know, it VC very seldom ever hit us during the day when we were in the south.
Mm-hmm.
They said they didn't want to be, they knew our firepower and things like that, so they pretty much tried to stay away from us during the day.
Mm-hmm.
The nighttime was a different story. That's when they did. They'd set up ambushes just like we did, and
mm-hmm.
you know, they would hit us at night. They were better operating at night.
Okay.
So, you know, at the night, it didn't belong to them, but they had a better chance at that time.
Okay. Okay. What about during the daytime?
During the daytime, we pretty much walked around and, you know, did pretty much everything that we wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, we patrolled a lot during the day and stuff, and squad size, and
mm-hmm.
We'd get shot at every once in a while, sniped at or something, but mm-hmm. nothing major during the day.
Did you prefer the daytime or nighttime?
I preferred the daytime, but, you know, depended on what you were doing.
Right, I guess that's true.
Yeah, if we were sitting in... If we were sitting in ambush, it was okay. If we were walking out on ambush,
right.
You know, if we were walking around out there at night, I didn't like it.
Right, right. Tell me what kind of supplies you had. What did you actually carry?
I carried a M16,
mm-hmm.
500 rounds of ammunition, a bayonet, helmet, flak jacket, web gear with 3 canteens, you know, we carry in our packs. We carry at least 2 sea ration meals,
mm-hmm.
Poncho, some personal gear. You know, like toothbrush, toothpaste,
mm-hmm.
soap, cigarettes. You know, then we carried machine gun ammunition, maybe a mortar round, some grenades and pop flares and. You know, just various things like that. We usually carried probably, I would say, 80 to 90 pounds of gear each.
Wow. How hard was that for you when you got there, adjusting to the heat and carrying that much weight?
It was tough at first. Just not that I was in pretty good shape to carry the weight, but the
right.
heat was just, you know, combined with the heat, it was kind of, it was a killer. You know, it was probably, it was over 100 degrees every day when I got there.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you to get used to humping that much stuff?
I think it took probably about a month.
Yeah. Did you have enough supplies in general the whole time you were there, or were you short at times?
There were times when we ran short, especially like during Hickory or something like that. But I mean, overall, well, in a caisson we ran short too, but overall I would say we had enough supplies.
Okay. What kind of food did you have?
Sea rations.
Right. Tell me what the sea rations were that you had.
They were little meals. They were actually from World War II.
Okay.
And just box meals, and you would have a can of your basic food, which could be ham and lima beans or pork slices or turkey loaf or something like that. And then you would have there's a little can of some kind of dessert, peaches and pound cake or fruit cake or some, you know, a little dessert. Maybe in that meal you'd get a chocolate bar, and you'd get a little special pack that had a little foil pack that had toilet paper and chewing gum and a little four-pack of cigarettes, a can opener, you know, and things like that, all in one can.
What was your favorite, Amari?
What was my favorite meal?
Uh-huh.
Oh, geez. I don't think any of them I could remember a favorite, but we all carried some spices to spice them up, and that made them a lot better.
Uh-huh.
So
uh-huh.
I don't think I had one favorite, though.
Okay. Did you ever sense any tension between those who were enlisted, like yourself, and then those who were kind of career, the officers?
You know, overall, I would say no.
Okay.
We had one officer that was kind of, and I won't never give any names or anything, but
right.
we had one officer, a lieutenant, that was kind of had us lost all the time and actually took us into North Vietnam one time when
really?
We weren't supposed to be there. And he had us online a couple of times attacking a hill that our own guys were on top of.
Wow.
And luckily we found out before anything happened.
Right.
But, yeah, he was not my favorite and a bunch of other ones, but other guys. But overall, our officers were real good. He was the only one that I can remember.
Okay. So how would you characterize the leadership, I guess, starting from your own officer on up? I
thought they were very good.
Yeah?
Well, a lot of them had been in the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, a lot of them were, you know, my platoon sergeant had been in the Korean War.
Mm-hmm.
My lieutenant had been in the Korean War. Our captain had been in the Korean War. And so they were pretty well, I mean, they were experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And they took real good care of the troops.
Mm-hmm. How about overall leadership in Vietnam, militarily?
Well, I don't know anything about anybody higher up than those guys.
Okay.
They just, you know, they never talked to me at all.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But, yeah, that's, you know, so I can't really give an opinion on that.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm. Tell me about your weapons. You said you switched over to the M16. How did it function?
Terrible. Functioned terrible
okay.
when we first got them.
All right.
As a matter of fact, they gave us these divining rods.
Uh-huh.
So every time you fired one shot, it would jam. And you had to shove the casing would jam in the chamber.
Mm-hmm.
There was something wrong with the powder and expanded too much. And then the casing, once it was fired, would jam in the chamber. And when it would go to eject the other round, it would shove it up on top and it'd jam it all up.
Hmm.
So you had to take this divining rod and shove it down the barrel, look like a muzzle loader,
mm-hmm.
and knock that casing out of there in order to get another round in there when we first got them.
I can only imagine how much that would disrupt in a firefight.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that happened mostly on Operation Canyon and that. By the time we got to Hickory, they were working fairly well. They were still jamming every once in a while,
mm-hmm.
but by the time they found out what the problem was, we had been in a couple firefights. Thank goodness they were with the NVA, with the VC, I mean. So, you know, I don't remember having anyone killed because a rifle jammed.
Right. Okay.
So,
were there any weapons that you did not have that you wished you did have?
No, we pretty much had everything that I could think of. I mean, I could have used a couple atomic bombs. But
okay.
I thought they could have used a few of those.
Uh huh. Can you describe what a typical day was like for you, Bill?
Well,
I know it varied, but...
Yeah, I would say a typical day was, you know, we'd be out on ambush somewhere, and we'd get up in the morning. You know, you'd be on 100% alert starting at 6 the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And get up, eat, maybe make some sea rations, eat them.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of anything that accumulate during the night, you know, if paper or any kind of stuff around there.
Mm-hmm.
Bury everything. Get ready. You'd go on patrol during the day. Almost mm-hmm. all day long you'd patrol.
And when you say patrol, can you describe what you mean?
You'd send us out in squads, and we'd just walk through the area and walk through villages and other things, looking for any sign of the, you know, we were searching for the VC. We were an infantry unit, so
mm-hmm.
our job was to find the VC and or NVA and fight them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we did. We patrolled all day looking for them, and I guess we were trying to get the fight.
How often would you find them?
Oh, we found them on numerous occasions, I would say. During my time over there, I would say I was in 40 or 50 firefights.
Hmm. Okay. And so you would patrol during the day, and...
And then, you know, we'd patrol, and we'd stop, take 10-minute breaks, and as soon as you got a 10-minute break, everybody, except whoever was on watch, passed out.
Okay.
Because you didn't get any sleep over there.
Uh-huh.
And then we'd patrol all day. Then we'd set up a perimeter when it came during the evening
mm-hmm.
hours. You know, we'd wait till dusk, and then we'd, you know, send out our ambushes and things,
mm-hmm.
or go out on ambush. Two out of every three nights he went out on ambush.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe what you mean? How would you set up the ambush?
Well, we would go out at dusk,
mm-hmm.
and we would, you know, we'd have a designated place that we were going to set up.
That you would find during the day beforehand?
Well, the officers would find them, and they'd just assign us a place, you know, along a trail. You still there?
Yes, I am.
They would find us a place along a trail or something, you know, mm-hmm. where they thought there might be some VC activity
mm-hmm.
or some NVA activity. And we'd walk out, and then before we got to the spot,
mm-hmm.
we'd bust back into the brush,
right?
Walk along the trail, you know, so we didn't give away our position. And then we'd lay alongside the trail in two-man positions,
mm-hmm.
you know, about every, I don't know, 8 to 10 yards or something,
mm-hmm.
and wait for somebody to walk through to shoot at.
How often would you find somebody?
Oh, well, I would, like I said, probably once a week,
mm-hmm.
maybe a little more often than that.
Okay.
And so then you, once you set up your positions on the ambush, you would stay on 100% alert until midnight,
mm-hmm.
and then you would sleep 2 hours on and 2 hours off. So one night you'd get 4 hours sleep, the other night you'd only get 2 hours sleep,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, you'd lay along the ambush, you'd lay along the trail, and when somebody walked through, depending on which end of the ambush, you'd let them walk all the way through,
mm-hmm.
if it was, especially if it was the VC.
Mm-hmm.
You'd let them walk all the way through, because as soon as you shot at them, they'd turn around and run them back the same way they came.
Right.
So everybody was going to get a shot at them.
Right.
So.
What about the NVA? How would they?
NVA would just stay there and fight your ass. They weren't runners.
Mm-hmm.
They knew if they stayed close to us, we couldn't use our artillery and air support and everything else against them. So,
okay. How important was our artillery and air support and the
very
superiority?
Very important. Yeah, because without that, I ain't sure we'd have won all the battles we won. I mean, we could go pretty much any place we wanted
mm-hmm.
because we had fire superiority.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm convinced that it helped us out of a lot of situations that I was in.
Okay. What other kind of tactics did you employ? Search and destroy and sweeps and ambushes. What else would you do?
Well, when we went on, you know, when we went up north against the NVA, we mm-hmm. worked pretty much in company size units.
Mm-hmm.
Because you didn't go up against the NVA with a squad or something on a normal basis, you know.
Right.
Because they were operating in large units also.
Mm-hmm.
So the tactics kind of changed up there.
Okay.
And you pretty much, you know, when we went on, as a matter of fact, when we went on things like Hickory and that. We were, you know, there were large units up there,
mm-hmm.
Battalions, and, you know, battalion-sized units mostly.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's those were the tougher fights.
Okay. You went on Canyon, I'm looking at your dates here, April 6th through 9th, 67, and then Operation Bighorn.
Yes.
Anything come back to mind about Bighorn?
Bighorn, basically, we didn't know what operations we were on. That was for the officers. And
okay.
That.
You were just told, here's
this is where we're going, and uh-huh. this is what you're going to do.
Uh-huh.
So, basically, you know, all I remember about a lot of them operations is we just ran ambushes and patrols. And, you know, as far as, you know, until we get up with the NVA, mm-hmm. All of them were pretty much the same to us.
Okay. Same thing for Operation Shawnee, that's 22nd April through 15 May?
Yes.
Okay. Where were you located during Bighorn and Shawnee, approximately?
Up near Fubai.
Okay. Okay. How much did the terrain change in Vietnam as you moved around the country up in I Corps?
The terrain changed from... When we were down there at Chu Lai and that, it was all sand and, you know, pretty much open.
Mm-hmm.
As you got into around Fubai, it became a little more hilly and mountainous.
Mm-hmm.
And as you got into, as you got up north near Con Tien, Cam Lo, mm-hmm. Khe Sanh and that, it was more mountainous, more jungle, more, you know, it was a lot more hilly and, mm-hmm. and jungle covered and stuff that... It made it tougher.
Which terrain did you prefer? What was easiest to work in?
I liked it wide open.
Okay. All right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
A lot of sense. Did your unit ever employ canine units?
We had them work with us a few times.
Yeah? What would they do?
I never worked with them individually,
mm-hmm.
but they would mostly, you know, walk out with ours. Squads and stuff that were on patrol in that, and then they would sniff out the VC or the, you know,
mm-hmm.
You know, they would alert for Viet Cong or NVA or whatever was out there.
Okay. How about the use of Marine snipers?
We use Marine snipers quite a bit.
Yeah. Can you tell me what they did? Kind of what?
Mainly, they operated by themselves.
Mm-hmm. Individual or in two-man teams?
Two-man teams.
Right.
Yeah, they would go out with us. They would go out with us when we went on an ambush or something
mm-hmm.
in the evenings, you know, and walked out. Once they knew that they were secure, we hadn't been followed or
mm-hmm.
whatever else, then when we would leave in the morning, they would go out on their own.
Okay.
They might stay and lay where we were at for the whole day
uh-huh.
and then the next night move.
Okay. Were they... working more of an autonomous way, or
yes,
okay, they had a little
except
more
at Khe Sanh, you know, we used them at Khe Sanh
right.
In our perimeter, but yeah, other than that, they would pretty much work by themselves.
Right. Okay. We're getting up to Operation Prairie 4 and Hickory.
Yes,
and this was one of the more significant battles of the war in 67, and particularly bloody for Hotel Company.
Yes.
Why don't we talk about what happened the lead up to Hickory? Again, was this an instance where you thought, okay, we're just going on out on search and destroy, running ambushes, or were you told?
No, this was different.
Okay. What was that like? How different?
Well,
was
we left from we were north of Fubai somewhere, and they brought us in and they put us on these trucks on Highway 1.
Mm-hmm.
Drove us up through Way City and mm-hmm. up to Highway 9,
okay.
Which ran east to west
mm-hmm.
through Northern I Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And on the way up there, Sergeant O'Keefe, the platoon sergeant, told me, he said, son, he said, you're going into a different kind of war now. So that didn't sound good to me.
Right. Did you ask him what he was talking about?
He said, he just told me, you know, that the NVA weren't going to run. And that... we made contact up there, it was going to get tougher.
Mm-hmm.
So,
how'd you feel?
Apprehensive, scared, mm-hmm. whatever. Everyone was. Everyone was quiet on the way up there because some of them before I'd gotten there had been up there before.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew what they were getting into.
Okay. Okay.
But so it was pretty quiet on the way up there. Everybody had their own thoughts.
Mm-hmm. You've been there, 2 months now, almost?
Yes.
Were you in now? Were you accepted?
Yes.
Okay. Had you made any good friends?
Yeah, I had made friends by that time.
Okay. Do you want to talk about any of them or some of these relationships?
Pretty much my whole squad: Paul Madero, Jeff Hitt, Robert Ramirez. I'm still trying to think here. Ron Marmon,
mm-hmm.
John Jones. I had made a bunch of friends by then.
Okay.
And I was pretty well accepted after. We had been in a few firefights, and they realized that I was going to do my part.
Right.
I think that was how you got accepted.
Okay. So once you arrived up, were you deployed along Highway 9 there?
Well, actually, they dropped us off at Camlo Village on Highway 9.
Okay.
And then we walked north from there up to the southern edge of the DMZ, right on the DMZ.
Mm-hmm. Did you know where you were? How close you were to the DMZ?
No, we did. We had no idea. I mean, the officers and that did, of course, but
mm-hmm.
I mean, as individual troops, we had no idea where we were.
Okay.
I mean, we knew we were up north, and we knew we were close to the DMZ, but as far as where we were, we didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's when we accidentally stumbled into North Vietnam.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How far in did you go? Do you know?
Well, I know we were on the wrong side of the damn river. Because the platoon sergeant told our officer at that time, he said, "This river is flowing the wrong way." And the officer said, "No, it isn't." And he said, "I'm telling you, the river's flowing the wrong way. We're in North Vietnam." And so the lieutenant called in, and sure enough, we were in North Vietnam.
Wow. Did you hightail it out of there, or did you stay?
We went back across the river, because, I mean, we weren't supposed to be over there.
Right. Right, obviously. Okay. Bill, why don't we take a break for a moment?